Hello and welcome to AstroTalk UK. AT UK is a not-for-profit 30-minute weekly audio podcast primarily for and by amateur astronomers in the UK. Available only online, AT UK is a virtual meeting point for the amateur astronomy community. Each episode is an MP3 file which can be downloaded automatically with a free subscription via one of the many podcast readers. I use iTunes. My name is Gurbir Singh and I host AT UK. I am not a scientist nor am I an astronomer. Topics of discussion have no fixed boundaries other than their relevance to amateur astronomy. Each week's episode consists of pre-recorded conversations with individuals discussing their roles, lives and achievements of amateur astronomers and their hobby. More about AT UK at www.astrotalkuk.org. If you have a topic for discussion, drop me a note on info@astrotalkuk.org. AstroTalk UK, amateur astronomy, expert opinion. Episode 22, Sunday, June the 29th, 2008. Interstellar dust. As episode 21 indicated, the power of science fiction to motivate the imagination is perhaps as strong as science itself. 1957 is known for the launch of Sputnik, but it was also the year that the scientist Fred Hoyle published a science fiction novel called The Black Cloud. One of its readers, in Italy, would be inspired by it to become an astronomer and embark on a career which involves the scientific study of such clouds. Eventually, this reader became the professor of astronomy at the University of Leeds, where Fred Hoyle had been a student. Professor Paolo Caselli was that reader, and since the autumn of 2007, she has been the professor of astronomy at the University of Leeds. Her area of interest is the study of those regions of space, of gas and dust, dark clouds, from which stars and planets eventually form. Modern cosmology has it that following the Big Bang and the subsequent inflation phase, minor variations in density of the interstellar medium triggered the process of gravitational collapse, which millions of years later would become galaxies. The solar system out to the orbit of Neptune is around 30 astronomical units. Professor Caselli works on the dynamics and chemistry of clouds much larger, around 50,000 astronomical units, which is about the size of the Oort cloud. These regions are still cold, but perhaps in the process of warming, as nearby compact areas start the journey to become denser and eventually become stars and planets. Dust comes in many forms: cosmic, cometary, and interplanetary dust, which is responsible for the zodiacal light which we can see from Earth. Professor Caselli investigates cosmic dust grains, atoms or molecules of silicon, magnesium, carbon, and others, which act like magnets and help suck out the volatiles from dust clouds in the early stages of star formation. Some of these processes are probably taking place right now in the recently announced discovery of HL Tau and its associated protoplanet HL Tau B. She will be speaking at the now famous Leeds Astromeet, which this year takes place on Saturday the 15th of November at the University of Leeds. Professor Paolo Caselli, welcome to AstroTalk UK.
Thank you.
Currently, you are the Professor of Astronomy in the School of Physics and Astronomy. Where were you working before that?
Okay, so before that, I was actually a researcher at the observatory in Arcetri, Florence, in Italy. And I spent 10 years there. And actually, the last 2 years of my, say, researcher position, I spent like in sabbatical outside. So I have been for a few months at University of California at Berkeley, and then I was at Harvard University, and then I moved here, finally.
Florence, and that's where Galileo spent some of his time.
Yes. In fact, I mean, from the top of the hill where the observatory is, we can see the house of Galileo, Galilei, where he died, actually. I mean, that was a beautiful villa, but it was his prison. And but he had the most fantastic view of the hills of Tuscany, you know, with olive trees and vineyards. It's a fantastic place to be.
Idyllic. How are you finding Leeds?
For me, it was the first time I was here for, say, a long time. I spent, say, a few weeks before because I was collaborating with a professor here at the university. I enjoyed a lot because, first of all, I like people. People is very friendly around here. And then surroundings are just beautiful. I didn't know how beautiful are Yorkshire dales are.
Have you tried Yorkshire pudding?
I think I tried, yes. A colleague of mine let me try, kind of forced me to try. And it was not bad.
Now, I've been involved in amateur astronomy for many years, and I seem to see there's more and more female astronomers out there, professional female astronomers. Do you see that?
Yes, I think that at least since I started, I have seen several women getting positions more than, say, 20 years ago.
And why did you become an astronomer?
Ah, that's a good question. It goes back in time, a long time ago, when I actually was in middle school in Italy. I was, you know, I come from a very simple family. They kind of probably didn't even know much about, you know, besides the sun and the moon. But I remember that I had a very good teacher in the second year of my middle class, which I think is probably year 10 here. And she let us read this book by Fred Hoyle, which is The Dark Cloud.
Oh, yes.
And that impressed me so much. The amazing thing is that it's not just that I decided to do, you know, a scientific career and do astronomy, but I'm working on dark clouds. I'm working on interstellar clouds, and very, very similar to what Fred Hoyle was talking about. Yeah. And in fact, I mean, the other amazing thing is that Fred Hoyle was born not far from here, and he actually studied in Leeds for some time. Unfortunately, I never met him. He died in 2002.
That must have been one of the earliest connections with Yorkshire, then, if you read his book.
Exactly, yeah.
Which areas of astronomy interest you?
My thesis was about astrochemistry, so I did some chemical modeling of molecular clouds in Ohio State. So during my PhD, I spent there only 9 months, but it was a very productive starting collaboration with the professor there, Professor Eric Herbst, who is one of the most famous at the moment in this field of astrochemistry. So the idea is to try to understand how organic molecules form in space, and we see lots of them, and we see lots of them in particular close by newborn stars. So when stars are born inside these cold and dense clouds, because you have a cloud that collapses and then forms a star in the center, once the star is formed, it starts to heat up the environment. And this heating helps, for some various reasons that we are still, you know, kind of struggling to understand, helps the chemistry in forming these very complex molecules that are actually the kind of seeds from which you start to have like amino acids and more complex species that in fact are observed, for example, in meteorites. So there is a nice link, say, from the star formation, which is, say, my field. So I'm studying how stars and planets form, and the chemistry. So the chemistry of life, say, how, you know, molecules form, assemble, and the other question, if these molecules that they form in, say, in space are able to be delivered once, you know, the star cleared up the cloud out of which it is formed, be delivered into the protoplanetary disk and then into planets. So it's very, this is like a part of what is called astrobiology, although I have not worked yet on, actively, say, on astrobiology, but it's part of it.
Yeah. some of the chemicals that you will encounter in your work, I guess the reactions would be astrobiological in nature.
Yeah.
But the scale of what you study is something that's huge, much larger than the solar system, which is becoming a star. So it's very early stages of star formation.
Yeah, it's early stages of star formation, so that typically these regions where the complex molecules are observed are quite compact around the star. So the sizes that are typically seen are not too far away from the size of the solar system, including the Oort cloud. The Oort cloud is about 50,000 astronomical units. Of course, also it depends which type of star is forming. So if we have massive stars, typically we see bigger regions.
Yeah, of course, yes.
And also we see extended organic molecule emissions in clouds. Typically, we do not see very complex molecules widespread. Mm-hmm. And this is an important question that we still need to answer. If we do not see them because we are not sensitive enough, I mean, the telescopes are not sensitive mm-hmm. enough to see them, or if it's true that these complex molecules cannot form in this cold environment. Because when I talk about cold, molecular clouds that we observe are typically 10 Kelvin. So like freezing temperatures close by newly born stars, we talk about 100 to 300 Kelvin. So like a warm, relatively warm to warm regions. So it's all there is lots of work to be done to understand this.
So those 100 Kelvin temperatures, are they sufficiently energetic to create the kind of reactions that you're looking at?
Yeah, that's a good question again, because it's what we think is going on, because it seems that the gas phase chemistry is not able by itself to, say, reproduce the abundance of these complex molecules that we observe. We think that what happens is that the molecules, complex molecules, forms on the surface of dust grains. So molecular clouds are formed by, of course, gas, majority of which is molecular hydrogen, but then, say, 1/100th of the mass of the molecular clouds is made out of dust grains, submicron sizes. So typically, say, 0.1 micron is the typical size of these dust grains, very, very tiny. But they get, once they are incorporating these molecular clouds, and especially when part of these molecular clouds condense to form the star, what happens is that molecules and atoms can freeze out onto dust grains and form icy mantles. And we see icy mantles, for example, when we look at background stars. So if we have like a molecular cloud and there is a star that is in the background and we look at the spectrum, the light from the star, we see, the spectrum of the star, the black body, but then we have some absorption features in correspondence exactly of, for example, water. Water ice is everywhere.
Really?
Yes, so these dust grains get these little ice mantles on top. And then, other molecules, other atoms goes in. And what we think is that an active surface chemistry goes on. So, like, the dust grain is like a catalyst. My English, that you see, is not a catalyst. And so you can form, organic, for example, lots of carbon, even carbon chain molecules that are observed. So once you increase the temperature of the dust above about 100 Kelvin. This is exactly the sublimation temperature for water ice at the conditions of the pressure that we observe in star forming regions. So these mantles evaporate. So once you have the evaporation of the mantle, so you release in the gas phase, together with water, all the molecules that have been formed there. So what we think is going on is that all these big molecules are really forming on the surface and then, just evaporate. However, it is possible that some of them, not everything is going back in the gas phase. And then when the dust reaches the protoplanetary disk, around the star and gets, you know, start to coagulate and become, say, bigger bodies and planetesimal. All these mantles of organic mantles are kept there, and they can be the starting point for the molecules that we observe in meteorites, for example, that are really complex. In meteorites, for example, there have been observations of 80 amino acids.
Eight zero,
different type of amino acids. And this is kind of amazing because if you think that life, I mean, from the smallest microbe to us, only uses 20 amino acids. So, you know, people now are starting to think how the, you know, how life could be diverse, you know, in different environments, because, you know, there is, still we do not understand why life selected these 20 amino acids. And also people, in fact, is struggling to, you know, making lots of laboratory work on this, and this is very fascinating. But you see, I mean, everything starts from, say, molecular clouds. For some reasons, there is this tendency, you know, to have complex molecules forming, even in very harsh conditions, because you can imagine, I mean, these molecular clouds that we observe, they are, you know, they have UV photons going through X-rays, cosmic rays, you know, it's a very, very harsh environment, but still, organic chemistry is very active.
This is along the lines what Fred Hoyle in his Black Cloud was writing about, and here you are today observing it.
It's
amazing.
Yes.
The dust grains are behaving a little bit like what happens in the atmosphere when rain drops are formed. You need a certain kernel around which things coalesce and then generate the process of, I think you call it freezing out.
What is freezing out are elements that are typically volatile,
I mean,
they stay, say, in the gas phase more easily, like carbon or even, say, oxygen. What is the dust made out of? It's silicon, magnesium, iron, all these heavier elements that actually form, or could be also, say, carbonaceous grains, and they typically form in evolved stars, in the atmospheres of evolved stars. So there is like a cooking mechanism, very high densities, and there is lots of carbon, and so carbon tends to form the rings or chains, and then the chains bent over, and you have the growing of these amorphous carbon grains. So then, once you have the silicate and carbonaceous grain released in the interstellar medium, then this becomes, this, say, the kernels, as you said, for the freezing out of more volatile elements and molecules, because they become very, very cold. The typical dust temperature in these molecular clouds are about 15 Kelvin, I mean 10, 15 Kelvin. So for a molecule, when, for example, if you have CO, which is one of the most abundant molecules, after H2 is the most abundant molecules in space, CO molecules hit the grain, and if the temperature of the grain is below 20 Kelvin, because this is the sublimation temperature, say, for the CO, you get the CO that just stuck on the surface, and it doesn't have the energy to go back to space. So, in fact, we see it. It's not that there is, of course, some theoretical work done, but it's also experimental work. We have maps of observation of CO in very dense regions, and we see, for example, that the mass peak, so where the concentration of the mass is, and we see that through observation of dust, because the dust is emitting at millimeters wavelengths when it is very cold. So in these regions, the CO actually disappears. We see like a hole of CO. So the only way, but we see, for example, peaks in other molecules. Other molecules are very bright, for example, in where there is all this material. So CO disappears, and what we think is the reason is that the CO is freezing out.
You said CO is the second most abundant molecule. Even more abundant than O2 and C?
Yeah.
Why is that?
A little bit of chemistry. O2 was supposed to be also very abundant, and in fact there was a satellite which was sent early 2000, the SWOS, submillimeter wave satellite, the main aim of the satellite was to observe water, which is very hard to observe, if not impossible to observe from Earth, because we have lots of water in the atmosphere, so we have lots of pollution, say, from the atmosphere of Earth for our observations. And O2, which was supposed to be very abundant. And actually, there was no detection of O2 at all. People was completely amazed about that.
Right.
So what's likely answer for this is that oxygen, again, before the cloud becomes molecular, before forming the CO, lots of oxygen is lost, again, on top of dust grains. So oxygen hits the dust grains, and because before becoming molecular, most of the hydrogen is still atomic, you have lots of atomic hydrogen in the gas phase, so once the oxygen is locked on the surface of the grains, you have rain of hydrogen atoms which hit the oxygen and form the most saturated form of oxygen, and that is water, H2O. Once water is formed, then it's not able to be released back in the gas phase unless you have lots of UV heating the grain. If you are in cloud, most of the oxygen is gone. Apparently, carbon is left out in the gas phase. One main difference between the two is that oxygen is mainly neutral in the gas phase. Uh-huh. Carbon is ionized in these regions, you know, before the cloud becomes molecular. So there may be some, you know, reason related to that. However, what happens is that the leftover of oxygen and the carbon that is in the gas phase very quickly combines to form CO.
You must be excited by a lot of what you've just talked about. It must actually be happening right now in the recently announced discovery of HL tau and this associated protoplanet, HL tau b.
Yes.
Have you seen this kind of activity going on?
I have to say I saw the announcement, but we are all waiting here for the scientific paper. The discovery, of course, is very exciting because it's the first time that somebody's forming planet in such an early stage. That's very interesting. But saying, great, this is really, you know, a forming planet instead of something that we need to see.
As a true scientist, you've got to see the data.
Yeah, we have to see the data.
What are the projects you're working on?
The moment I work on star forming regions, so we are trying to understand how, first of all, molecular clouds form, and then how condensation within molecular clouds form, and then how stars within these condensations form. So we have like large-scale maps of, for example, CO, but also other molecules that trace denser regions. And we are tracing the deuterium fractionation, which is another very interesting thing. So we observe, for example, particular N2H+, which is a very good tracer of N2, molecular nitrogen, which is not observable because as H2 doesn't have a permanent dipole moment, which means that it's just is not able to emit any radiation at the conditions that we observe in molecular cloud. But N2H+, which is just coming from N2, you just need to make the N2 react with a very important molecular ion in space, which is H3+.
There's a lot of chemistry here.
Yeah, there is a little bit. I mean, at the end, it's not so complex. I mean, it's not like, you know, the organic chemistry that one does in a chemistry university. In fact, sometimes students are a little bit scared. Say, oh, no, I have to study chemistry as well. And these things are very simple because, you know, very, very few molecules and the simple molecules still. So we observe N2H+ and N2D+ to determine the D over H ratio, which apparently is changing a lot in the interstellar medium. And this is also very interesting from the point of view of astrobiology again, because, for example, on Earth, the ratio between deuterated water, so HDO, and water, H2O, is enhanced compared to the cosmic abundance of the deuterium. So we have like, about the factor of between a few and 10 times more in the oceans than the deuterium, the D over H ratio that we observe, say, cosmic abundance of deuterium. Uh-huh. So the deuterium that has been produced in the Big Bang, essentially.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we observe these molecules, so we try to have an idea of the chemical processes going on, and we use the molecules also to determine, of course, the physical properties, which are, you know, very important for star formation, like the densities, the temperature, and then also the kinematics, because molecular lines have a very...
That's the motion defined, of the molecules.
Yeah, they have very, very well-defined lines, so... If we notice some, you know, shifts in the frequencies, we can actually trace these shifts, and together with some model, we can try to explain that with internal motions, which helps theoreticians to understand how clouds, dense clouds, and stars form. So there is lots of connection and interactions between many different fields of astronomy.
And a lot of your data comes from spectroscopes, and I understand you're working on, or part of the team's working on, the spectroscope for the Herschel satellite, which is due to be launched next year.
Yeah, actually at the end of this year, so we are
really
excited.
End of this year? I see.
Yeah.
And how will that spectroscope be different from the ones that have been in orbit in the past?
Well, that will work at frequencies that are unavailable from Earth. For us, it will be like opening a new window to the universe. It's going to be very, very exciting. And especially it will allow us to see water, lots of water lines that, again, are not observable from Earth. So it will give us, all we want to know about water content in the universe, from local regions, but also nearby galaxies. And there are also projects to study faraway galaxies. And so at higher and higher redshifts, galaxies become more and more bright at long wavelengths. There are two main projects where I am in. One is called WISH, which is the water and star forming regions with Herschel. And that's just look for water in all kind of region, from molecular clouds to protoplanetary disks. And then there is another one, which is called the spectral survey of star forming regions again. So in this case, we take only one region where, for example, one dense core where stars form, but where stars have not yet formed, one core where the star is in, one more evolved region where we see, you know, the star at the protoplanetary disk, and we actually observe the whole spectrum, the whole bandwidth of Herschel, to see, you know, which molecules are there. Because one of the problems that astrochemists like me are facing is that we do not know all the frequencies of all the molecules that we expect to be in space, because it's very hard to reproduce molecules in the lab. And this is what we need, to have the frequencies exact. This is again another interaction. We have lots of interaction with chemists. And in fact, even here in Leeds, I'm already collaborating with some people in the chemistry department, School of Chemistry, because they are the ones who provide us with the frequencies. So what we expect from Herschel is that plenty of new lines, probably most of them we will not know exactly what they are, so we will have to actually work continuously with the chemists at that point to try to identify all the lines.
I think that will keep you busy
for the rest of my life.
Most of what you described stems from the dust grains.
Yes.
Or the chemistry of the processes that you're describing require these dust grains. And these dust grains would have been produced as a result of supernovae over the years, bearing in mind that the universe is currently 7.6 billion years old. There's been plenty of time to have supernovae to generate these dust grains. In the early universe, say when it's 1 or 2 billion years ago, I guess the processes would be very different.
Yeah, in fact, right now in our galaxy, what we think is the main source of dust grains are these so-called AGB stars, these giant branch, asymptotic giant branch stars, which are stars, at the end of their lives. So when they have pounding shells and they have very dense shells where actually dust grains can form, and we have like oxygen rich and carbon rich, and depending on which star we are talking about, we have silicate grains or carbon ashes grains. The evidence of dust formation in supernovae is quite recent thing. And this is coming, I think, of course, again, because lots of technology has improved, and now we can really see in the infrared much better than before. But I think all these, when you look at the work done by cosmologists who are interested in the first stars and, the first galaxies, they always talk about, as you said, dust formed in supernovae. Now, this is quite, again, a little confusing because, for example, in our galaxy, we also know that supernovae destroyed dust grains because with the shocks,
right.
The dust grains start to shatter and collide, they get destroyed. The process of dust formation in supernovae is a very tricky one. There is some dust formation, but they also, when these shockwaves propagate in clouds, they also destroy dust. So, for sure, you have to have first stars before. Mm-hmm. So, the first stars are supposed to be formed out of gas without any dust,
right.
So only hydrogen, and that's very exciting field, of course. So, you get these very massive stars, and then soon after that, you have the production of heavier elements out of which dust is forming. So, dust is supposed to form quite early. How early, experimentally, we do not know. So far, I think the farthest quasar that has been observed, very, very rich in dust, is at redshift 6.4. And so it's like about 800. So it was formed. We are observing this galaxy as it was just 800,000 years from the Big Bang. So compared to the 13.7 billion years,
so it's very, very young.
And it's very rich in dust. When the people started this type of research, they thought that, going back in time, we have to have a drop in dust flux. But indeed, this is not the case. As far as we know, we see, quite a lot of dust.
Well, I remember learning about these processes when they were first talked about 20, 30 years ago. And it's great to see that today you're out there observing, measuring. Next year you'll be doing that from in orbit as well.
Yeah.
Professor Paolo Caselli, thank you very much indeed.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah, it was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to AstroTalk UK. AT UK is a non-profit project produced and recorded by Gurbir Singh. He nor any of the participants are paid for their contribution. AT UK's content is not validated against any authoritative source, and all the views and opinions are held by those who choose to express them. If you have a topic of interest you would like to discuss on AT UK, drop me a note, info@astrotalkuk.org.